The Team Never Quit podcast is sponsored by Navy Federal Credit Union. Navy Federal can help you get started on your next home improvement project. Learn more at NavyFederal.org. Our members are the mission.
Team Never Quit. Team Never Quit. Team Never Quit Radio.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to the TNQ podcast. I'm your host, Marcus Luttrell. Every week, it's my job to fire you up, to ignite the legend inside of you, and to push you to your greatness. Join me every week as I take you into my briefing room with some of the most hard-charging people on the planet. They're going to show you how to embrace the suck of life, teach you the values of working your ass off, and charge through whatever life throws at you. This is the Team Never Quit podcast. So buckle up, Buttercup.
What's going on, guys? Welcome back to another episode of the Team Never Quit podcast. It's a beautiful day here in Texas. The weather is perfect, I think. It's not too cold, not too hot. And if you've got New Year plans, maybe new goals for the year, I saw a pretty crazy article this morning that says Oscar Mayer is looking for new Wienermobile drivers. So if you're looking to try something new in the New Year, Marcus,
why would I be?
I know you like to drive that, you know, that RV. Y'all took that cross-country trek.
That would be awesome. You could drive a hot dog van.
You can drive a hot dog.
Okay, so would you drive the hot dog van if the inside was all decked out and they let you use it for free to do your vacation, just as long as you advertise for them?
That's a good trade.
That?
Yeah.
Hey, but hey, if I'll borrow your vehicle, you can wrap it in your deal and I'll use it on my trip.
No, it looks like a hot dog.
My point, exactly. I know which one it is. We ran into that sucker at the Alamo.
Yeah, we saw it at the Alamo.
Oh, gosh. All right, well, Patreon question of the day for you guys. Would you rather be able to speak any language fluently or be able to communicate with animals?
Is it the same thing?
No. I would rather...
Are you supposed to answer to that?
Yeah, yes. Go for it. Yes, sir.
Well, probably animals, because they're always observant. They're always around, and they see things that most people do not. And they also are in, like my dog. I mean, he knows what's going on just by the tone of the voices. So I think the ability to talk to animals would be more important than the ability to speak to a specific individual in a specific language.
I agree with that, because even we've traveled abroad a lot and you can always basically understand what someone's saying for the most part. So to be able to speak to animals, I think would be really, really cool.
Oh, sure.
Well, just if you got a dog or a cat, just consider what they see. Mm-hmm. But they can't talk about.
Yeah.
I mean, some people have dogs in their bedroom. I mean, what do you want?
I appreciate they don't talk back, okay?
Yeah.
They're amazing.
Yeah. Marcus is kind of like the animal whisperer.
I tell you, yeah, I'd rather have that ability too.
Yeah.
Because here's why. Humans on our meanest animal form, when there's no discipline or anything like that, if you look over and somebody has the ability to control a lion or a Cape Buffalo or something that'll eat you or kill you, mm-hmm. all humans will fall in line.
Yeah.
That's just the way it is.
Well, and I feel
if you're walking across the Serengeti, you need to know who's hunting you.
That's right.
Yes.
Yeah. That's right. Because it feels different and it is different. For sure. Yeah,
for sure. Okay. Well, that was our Patreon.
That's a great Patreon question. Hey, check it out. Patreon.com/TeamNeverQuit. You can ask your questions. You can get access to some exclusive gear and definitely join that amazing community that allows us to put the show together every single week. So thank you guys, Patreons, for all you do to support the show. We've got a guest that's almost unbelievable on the show today. Keith Nightingale is a retired Army colonel who served two tours in Vietnam with airborne and ranger units. He commanded airborne battalions in both the 509th Parachute Infantry Regiment and the 82nd Airborne Division. He later commanded both the 175th Rangers and the 1st Ranger Training Brigade. He was a member of the Iran Rescue Attempt in 1981 and served with several classified organizations. And to top it off, he's also an author. He's the author of Phoenix Rising. Keith, welcome to the show, sir.
My pleasure to be here. Fire away.
All right. Well, this is one of those things that...
You can't even read your bio because of how
I had to pick highlights.
Well, no, exactly. when someone's bio starts reading like radio instructions.
That's right.
Because like there's the so many fast acronyms. Talk. Yeah, there's so many abbreviations and acronyms. You'd have somebody in the high in the military couldn't even read this. So I just want to hear, if you just back this up.
Can you tell us, yeah, like about.
I want to know where you came from.
Yeah,
where God put you down here. Wait, what state?
Well, let me see. You're asking how my experience or why I got involved in the military.
I'm asking where you were born and your background on your family, how you.
All right.
I want to go all the way back, like mom and dad. What'd they do?
My family has been had some association with the military since the Pilgrims, literally, with John Alden. And we've always had some member of the family, male members, participate in whatever wars the country went through. Daniel Manton, who is a direct relative of mine, my name's Keith Manton Nightingale. Daniel Manton was a colonel for Washington in the Rhode Island militia, and he did the recon for Washington before he sieged New York City. He also raised a number of units for Washington during the Revolutionary War. My great-great-grandfather was a lieutenant quartermaster at Hilton Head for the Union Army, died of yellow fever. And my great-great-uncle was with Buford on day one at Gettysburg. Past that, my great-uncle was a doctor in World War I, the only doctor to win a Distinguished Service Cross. My grandfather drove an ambulance for the French Army in Verdun. My grandmother was a nurse at the military hospital.
Y'all were in Verdun?
Say again?
Oh, go. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt.
He's in awe.
Yeah, go ahead.
My father was an advisor to the Chinese in World War II, was Stillwell, and I'm the product of them, if you would. So I come from a long line of kind of, I call it disassociated military, because none of them were professional. They went in, you know, there was a war, they did their thing, and they went home and they did whatever, you know, they did. I'm the only one actually in our entire family history that I know of that made the Army a career. But I enjoyed it. I was supposed to be a lawyer. That was my grandmother's plan. And after my first tour, she kept lobbying me to, you know, go to Stanford Law and, you know, get out of this military stuff. You've done your bit. And I just thought about it a while and said, no, this is something I really like. You know, with the people I was with and what we were doing, it was just a real draw, if you would. And so I decided to do that, and I've never regretted it.
I wouldn't either with all of your accomplishments.
Brothers or sisters?
No, I'm an only child. My parents were old and had arguments.
Well, I came from one of them families too, brother. Okay, so how'd that go? What actually spun you up to join the Army? Because signing up and then your family.
All right, I'll tell you that. Because of our family history, it was preordained that I would go into the Army and serve some time and then go out and do whatever the rest of my life was going to be all about. So when I went to college, I signed up for ROTC, which is what my father had done when he was at Stanford. And then I kind of liked it because I had a military background. You know, I was an Army brat. You know, I grew up at Fort Lewis and, you know, these other places, military places, saw my dad off to Korea. So I kind of understood what was going on here. And then when I was in college, Claremont, at that time, Claremont Men's College in Claremont, California, I was part of the ROTC organization, and I kind of liked it. And then it was clear that Vietnam was going to happen. I mean, this was like 63, 64, it was building up. And I done a lot of studying of history. History was kind of my thing, and particularly military history. And I decided I wanted to be in the 82nd Airborne Division, because if I was going to go to war, I wanted to go to war with the best, you know, General Gavin and General Ridgway and Normandy, D-Day, all that stuff. A very magnetic attraction to me. And the only way that I could go to the 82nd was to get a regular Army commission as opposed to a reserve commission. So I applied for a regular Army commission so that I could go to jump school and then go to the 82nd, and I got it. And so I was the only graduate in Claremont with a regular Army commission. I went commissioned, ironically, on the 6th of June, 1965.
Oh,
nice. Immediately signed up to go to Fort Benning. By that time, I had been married as a junior. Between my junior and senior year, I got married. We had a kid. So I have a wife, a baby, and a parakeet. And we all load up in the...
Hey, write that combo down just in case you run across it again.
You can start up a joke right there.
Yeah.
I know this guy.
We all load up in my Chevy Corvair and head to Fort Benning, where I go to the basic officer school, jump school, then go to the 82nd. And then they send me back as an 82nd guy to Ranger school. Then I come back to the 82nd, where I then got orders to go to Vietnam as an advisor.
You signed up, you still got an advisor role. That doesn't tell you that your family's got a particular job down here.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. The Corvair, was it convertible?
It was not. But it had for our situation, it was great. You know, it was an air-cooled car, air-cooled engine, and it actually drove fast. Stick shift with a clutch.
Two-door or four?
Say again?
Two doors or four?
It had two doors.
Two doors, right.
But, you know, for a wife, a baby, and a parakeet, that was, you know, pretty much all we needed. We didn't have a whole lot of junk.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And so that's sort of how it got started. I mean, I spent about 18 months, a little less than 18 months in the 82nd. I actually was the only second lieutenant company commander in the 82nd, not because I was great, but simply because all the captains had been sent to Vietnam. So I was sort of the last man standing.
When they send you over there?
That was my, call it my initiation into the Army.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I remember my time over there with them. That the 82nd has a sign at the front of the base. If they can go 82 days without anybody dying, they get an extra day of liberty. And they never do it.
In war?
No, in peacetime.
Oh, really?
Oh, the 80s, man, they're the crazy. You want to see what an inside of a can whoop ass looks like? It's my favorite poster. Is when they drop the ramps and you look inside those dirty Hercs, those 130s, and it's got the 82nd in there all crammed in. Bunch of badasses. And they do these mass exits out in a blue sky, like just these hundreds of parachutes of dudes coming down. It's something to watch them hit a field, man.
We want to give the enemy the maximum opportunity to give his life for his country.
That's right. Wow. That's right. Dude, if they don't shoot you, man, when they come in squashing like that, that's the craziest thing I'd ever seen when I saw y'all do that for the first time. Okay, so when you got sent to Vietnam, how long were you over there?
I was in Vietnam. I arrived in April of 1967. I left in May of 1968. That included
second lieutenant.
Offensive in Vietnam. I started out as the deputy senior advisor. Captain Al Schein was the senior advisor, and then he left in early December, and I became the senior advisor, which I was throughout the rest of my tour there.
What was that like for you?
Well, Vietnam. Exciting. it wasn't exactly deer hunting. I joined them, as I said, in April. I had my first real action purely by chance in late April on a patrol in the Rungsap, which was this swampy area south of Saigon, up the Saigon River, a lot of VC. And then later on, it got really serious. 24 June 1967, we as a battalion, 450 people, went in to this LZ up north in what's called War Zone D near the Dong Nai River, north of Swan Lock, which was where we were at. And we were supposedly chasing a VC company. Well, it ended up being a well-laid ambush by two VC main force regiments. In the course of about less than 24 hours, we went from 450 people to 32 people. Later, after the battle was over, we collected a total of about 150 out of those 450. So that was kind of what I call a very exciting day for me.
Oh, yeah.
And then later on, we went down to reconstitute because we were basically decimated down to Cu Chi, that area in south of Saigon. We brought in a lot of new replacements and did training and all that. Had a totally different environment, VC villages, booby traps, sniping, totally different kind of war. Up in Swan Lock, where I was at, it was very conventional. I mean, you went after companies and battalions.
Yeah.
Down in Cu Chi area, it was, you know, little groups of people, two or three or four, but they were working at a distance, and they never really stood and fought with you. But they would whack you from, you know, 500 meters, and you never saw them. So it was a very difficult situation. And then later on, of course, during Tet, that was very conventional. We had half of the battalion at Swan Lock defending the airfield, and the other half had left earlier to go down to a place called Berea and work with the Australians to clear the province capital down there, which had been taken over by the VC during Tet. That was really tough fighting, very urban warfare. Completely different from what I'd had before. And we finally married up with the battalion, the rest of the guys down at Berea, and then cleared that area and then went into Saigon and did the clearing of Cholon up there toward the Y Bridge and then over to Benoit. And that was like 3 weeks plus of just heavy grinding combat. Very different from what we had had before, but very similar to what you say you might have seen at Stalingrad or Bastogne.
Oh, Vietnam, guy, they didn't even begin to talk about y'all's wars. I started studying military history, is like really getting into it, and y'all's especially, because it was always ambushes. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. It was a terrorist war and a conventional one. You had both sides. I mean, both of them.
You had the full deck of cards all the time.
All the time.
You never knew what it was till it happened.
Till they stuck your ass in it. And I mean, the death toll on y'all and how fast it was. That was the craziest thing, too. Plus, they were rotating guys in and out. I can't believe y'all made it through all that.
Yeah. Well, then, not to mention, like, the welcoming home wasn't great. So,
that's the worst. We all had it the worst. Thank God y'all took that for us, because y'all made it the best for us when we came back. We had a pure, straight up terror war. And
well, yeah, the anti-war folks focused on the soldiers. They didn't really focus on the people that sent them there, if you will.
Right.
So the soldiers became kind of the touch point for people's frustration and anger, which was totally misplaced.
Sure.
Yeah,
we just went there sort of because we had to.
Had to.
You know, my rifle company on my second tour in the 101st was composed what I call the dodgeless drafters. They couldn't dodge the draft, you know, for whatever reason. They got caught up in it. You know, they either didn't graduate or they were about to go to jail or, you know, they didn't have a future or whatever. So they got drafted. But they were great soldiers. I mean, they were peaceniks. They were beatniks. They were anti-war to the core, but they were hellacious in combat because they understood that that's what they needed to do to survive. And that's what they wanted to do. So, you know, people denigrate the folks that were in Vietnam. Well, I saw them, you know, at all levels. And, you know, they were a superb part of our population.
So we don't have that. Mm-hmm. I didn't get to see that type of human. I never got to see that because they didn't make us go do that. Yeah. We all volunteered to go in. So the lions and tigers and bears that I always ate with, man, they kind of trained us in a different route. And I haven't heard anybody say it like that. I mean, there is literally people who hate violence so much that it drives them. When they're the ones that get put in it, they fight the worst. They're the meanest son of a guns you ever met. And when you see them on the backside when they get back home, you'd had no idea they would have been in there because they hated it so much. But yeah, I never had that.
They clearly understood if they were in the middle of the A-Chow that they better have their act together.
Holy shit, right?
Be hauled off in a box.
Yeah. God, that's got to be a fear. I wouldn't even know. Imagine that. I mean,
you don't
getting stuck
fear,
in that.
You focus.
Yeah. How about that?
Your fear turns into focus.
Because you don't have any way out.
Yeah. Well, and it's focused on survival.
Yeah.
Getting home.
How soon after you got in did you decide, all right, this is going to be a career?
When I came back from my first tour, like I said, you know, my family was lobbying me to get out and go to law school. And I thought about that for a while and said, no, this is what I want to do.
Was it kind of some, like the times back then when you would have been rotating out into the world comparable to now? Was it kind of chaotic with the war and everything?
Well, yeah, I mean, there was pressure. You know, people would approach me, you know, once they understood, hey, I just got back from Vietnam, blah, blah, blah. They acted with great sympathy, you know, like I was at a funeral, you know, with some relative. It wasn't a thank you and it wasn't a gee, what it was like. It was, you know, oh, fine, you know, I'm sorry, you know, blah, blah. You know, that's basically the way it was. So I felt kind of isolated from our society. I liked what I was doing in the military with the people I was at. I felt proud for what I was doing. I didn't have any apologies. So, you know, when I came home, I saw two groups of people, my kind of people and a lot of the rest. And I just decided to hang with my people.
Yeah.
I can see that. Yeah.
Oh, and they make it easy to do that too when they're yelling. I mean, that's kind of, it's no brainer, especially if you put your life on the line with everybody.
Yeah. Well,
that's one thing in the uniform,
man. When I returned, I was assigned to Cal Poly San Luis Obispo.
That's a terrible place
where we live. And it had a big ROTC detachment. And actually, they were very conservative, very pro. I mean, we had like 400 cadets, and most of them were in the county sheriff's reserve organization. And they deployed to all of these other California universities, like UCSB, that were having these massive riots. They just loved it because they got a chance to actually deploy and exercise.
Sure. Exercise, yeah.
But all around us was this tremendous, you know, student uprest and draft card burning and flag burning and, you know, counselor yelling and screaming at the students. So, you know, I wanted to get out of there and go back to Vietnam and kill communists. You know, I just get me out of this place.
Yeah. All right. So when you rotate back from Vietnam,
when the war was over.
Yeah. Next step. What was that like?
When I left ROTC, I went to Fort Benning for what's called the advanced course for captains, and then was immediately shipped out to the 101st, where I joined. This was 1970. And I was given a rifle company out in the A-Chow, which I had for almost 6 months, going around a whole variety of jobs. Very interesting, primarily as an independent company rather than as part of the battalion per se, which I enjoyed. And then I was, you know, they always kick you out. You get 6 months and then you got to leave so somebody else can take your job.
Right, yeah.
I became the G2 operations officer for the 101st, which was really interesting because it opened me up to all the all-source intelligence, the HUMINT. We had the MAC-SOG guys and Combat Command North. We had all of the sensor strings. I was responsible for monitoring the Ho Chi Minh Trail between Vietnam, Laos, and North Vietnam. And I also had all the ArcLight targeting responsibilities in I Corps for the B-52s. So I had a really fun day every day putting all this stuff together and seeing what was going on. So it was very educational, very creative, and I just enjoyed the hell out of it. Then I came back as part of the 173rd to Fort Campbell, Kentucky, and we became the Airborne Brigade for the 101st. And from there, I joined the 1st Ranger Battalion when it was created at Fort Stewart, because the battalion commander, Colonel Luer, was also a battalion commander in the 101st. That's where we met. So he picked me to be join the Ranger Battalion when it was first created.
That is so cool.
Timing's everything, right?
Like, hey, I have been a big believer that life is luck and timing.
Oh,
that's what my dad
said. Sounds made up. That first part, I mean, the fact that you stepped into this, and mainly because I've had to walk in the streets and all that stuff that you were around to create. That's the best part about running into y'all. That's why I get such a kick out of this, man, just hearing all those stories. I went over my time. I'm a bastard. I'm an Army brat bastard, so I'm an 18 Delta. And I had more fun running around with the Rangers and Green Berets and up in Benning and Bragg, too.
Yeah, where was your 18 Delta training?
I was at Bragg for that. Bragg. But Benning is our airborne school. So I got full Bennings, too, because I was there in the summertime. I think I graduated June 6th.
You're an 18 Delta?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Yes, sir. And which I love. I put more work into getting that done than I almost did my Trident. It was that hard. It was that difficult for me. So it paid off, though, when we got into the war. Because, I mean, you kind of recognize your own pretty quick.
Absolutely.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt. So, because here's the deal. I tell these young guys this. I'm like, hey, man, if you're real squared away, your department won't let you leave. But if you're a shitbag, then they won't send you away. They won't send you somewhere cool to do something else. So there's actually a happy medium you got to hold in the military. It's a fine line. So when you run across guys who have these write-ups, man, like this one, I'm sorry to keep bringing that up, but you got to understand, it's just cool.
Yeah.
Well, like I said, it's luck and timing. I can guarantee you that there is nothing that I did that I planned for before it occurred. It just sort of happened. I stumbled into it, or events were such, and I was there, and that's what I did. But there was zero prior planning to get me to anything that I did in my career. It was basically, like I said, luck and timing.
All right. So Vietnam, you're still...
Yeah.
That winds down. Then you go into the agency, right?
Say again?
You started working for the agency after the through the Army or after?
After I left the Army or before, or what?
We're trying to figure out the timeline.
I worked for the agency. I got to be careful here. when I was in the Army in what was called ODSO, right after the Iran rescue, we had a special organization set up to develop and resource all of these special ops units you see now, right, that did not exist during the Iran rescue. Only Delta existed. We brought in a whole bunch of new stuff. Task Force 160, the aviation guys.
Oh, yeah.
What was then called FOG, Field Operations Group, which is now ISA, the Secret Army of Northern Virginia, and a number of other kind of special, select, unique organizations. We did a lot of stuff outside the United States, Latin America and the Middle East. During those periods, we would kind of transition back and forth from being sheet dipped in the agency to going back to wearing a uniform.
Yeah, check.
Just depended on the circumstances and the requirements.
Right.
And then later on, when I was a civilian, I did some work with them and for them also.
Nobody really works for the agency. That's what I've always heard. Kind of, you're just with them or away from them.
But that wasn't until later. You still had a lot of time in the Army.
From what we were talking about. When I was through with my tour at the 1st Ranger Battalion, I went to Command and General Staff College at Fort Leavenworth. From there, I was assigned to the 509th Airborne in Vicenza. During that three-year period, I was the executive officer, the deputy commander, and the battalion commander. The battalion commander had been relieved for a couple of reasons, and I was the battalion commander for about 8 months, to include taking him through an RTEP in Germany. At that point, I came back assigned to the Pentagon. I was in what was called DEMO, Department DEMO Des Ops, which was the operations side of the Army. We did things, sent people off in the world, and, you know, did all of the kind of day-to-day operations of the large Army. And that was the point that the Iran embassy went down. My responsibility in Des Ops was the Middle East Africa desk, which at that time was kind of a low, slow, no big deal thing other than the Beirut, Lebanon problems we had. General Vaught was the director of DEMO Des Ops. And he was assigned by General Meyer, the chief staff of the Army, to create a rescue force for the embassy, because we had nothing. When the embassy went down, the Joint Chiefs had a meeting in the tank and looked at their options. Well, option A was a nuclear strike. Option B was send in the 82nd Airborne. There was nothing in between. So it was clear that there was some form of lower order capability had to be developed. And at that point, General Meyer told him, we need to create a new force, and I'll provide the commander, in which case this General Vaught, and the base units would be Delta, which has just finished their evaluation exercise and came online. General Vaught brought me up to be part of the organization. I wore a number of hats. We only had 32 people from General Vaught on down. I was the J3 Ground Operations Officer, which was a title that didn't mean anything because I was really the lowest ranking guy in the room. I was the organizational gopher.
Yeah, it sounds important, though. That's how that title usually works. If it's real badass, that's the lowest ranking guy in there.
I can tell you that being the gopher was a great job because I got involved in everything. I gave the morning briefings and the afternoon briefings to all of the high muckety mucks who came in there every day, Secretary of Defense, the service chiefs, Brzezinski from the National Security Council, Ham Jordan from Carter's office. And so I got to see all these people at work and how their minds worked and, you know, whether they were good, bad, or indifferent.
Yeah.
And so you could see at the highest level how the sausage was made, if you would.
Sure.
And then we took that immediately back down to the field and said, hey, we got this new intel and you got to turn left instead of turning right. So, you know, I'd go down and brief Beckwith and his guys on the new deal. And then eventually we brought in the Rangers, Dave Grange and his guys, C Company 175. You know, I'd be briefing them on what was going on. Of course, we went out to the desert continuously to do the training. You know, we'd be out in the desert for a weekend, and then we'd come back to the Pentagon, wear our Class A uniforms, and then we'd go back out into the desert in our fatigues and go shoot weapons. You know, you had this back in
made up
world all the time.
I don't have as much fun in the military. This is a recruiting poster here. This is why you join, just in case you can get in this kind of lifestyle, man.
So. Then, the rescue comes off, and, of course, it doesn't come off the way we planned, but that actually was a blessing in disguise. Whacking bin Laden was a direct result of the failure at Desert One. If we had succeeded at Desert One, I am absolutely convinced, as I say in my book, that the service chiefs would have basically eliminated this special ops capability that was created. They didn't like it. They hated it. It was different. It was unconventional. They viewed it as high risk, low payoff, loose cannon on rolling deck, et cetera. Sure. And they wanted nothing to do with it. Well, the failure totally changed the equation because Carter said, hey, you guys got to go back in 10 days in case we have an in extremis rescue requirement. We'll get whatever we can get and we'll just take the casualties to do it. And so the other point he made was no resource constraints. We had resource constraints for the rescue because it had to be so secret, you know, nobody could know about it.
Sure.
So we couldn't go into the general base and get goodies or put in new money to get stuff like we have the only three satellite radios in the entire inventory. You know, give you an example.
What he's talking about is people know where that stuff goes.
Yeah.
Like if you're trying to do something top secret.
All the kind of neat little toys didn't exist.
Yeah.
But when the rescue failed and we got the new orders, which was you have number one priority, whatever you want, dream it up and we'll figure out how to make it happen.
Oh.
You got all the money you want. You got all the people you want.
Dang.
Just go make something real that works. And that's when we grew, like I said, we created Task Force 160. We seriously upgraded the Air Force Special Operations Wing, you know, and all these other things. But I can tell you the institutional establishments, the senior leadership and the civilian bureaucracy hated it. They would try to kill it at every opportunity. And we had to continually stuff them when they tried to stuff us. And in that, we got Congress involved. A couple of us would go up on the Hill, back door, brief the chairman and the ranking members of the HAC and the SAC and the SASC and the SAC, Senator Nunn, Senator Cohen, and they'd write laws. You know, we say, we got a problem. You know, the Air Force won't do this. So they just write a law saying the Air Force will do this.
Well,
of course, you know, that doesn't make you a good friend of the chief of staff of the Air Force, but it does get us airplanes on the ground.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's sort of the battles that we had to fight. From there, I went to the 82nd to command 2505, took them to Grenada, took the division back to Normandy for D-Day, one of my obsessions. For the 40th anniversary, first time division had returned to Normandy. General Gavin met us on the ground with like 12 busloads of vets who toured us around everywhere, gave us the battle staff rides on the sites.
How was that?
That's really
was that awesome?
That was seriously awesome. When you when you are with General Gavin, I'll give you an example. On the 5th of June at St. Mariglise, there was a big banquet in the town itself. First time they'd had the actual vets back to St. Mariglise. Well, the town went all out, and we had this big banquet, and I was sitting at the table. I was the commander of troops, and I was sitting at the table with General Gavin. And on the spur of the moment, I said, sir, would you give us we're going to do a staff ride tomorrow at Lafayette Bridge. Lafayette Bridge was kind of the penultimate battle the 82nd did in Normandy. And we had not planned to have him there. I hadn't thought of it. We were going to have, you know, another vet do it. And he kind of looked at me and he said, well, if you can get me to Omaha Beach by 9, I have an appointment with Cronkite. I'll talk to you guys at 6:30. And he was starting to get Parkinson's, you know, he was kind of shaky like that. And so I immediately went up and grabbed the gendarme major and I said, can you get General Gavin from Lafayette Bridge to Omaha Beach by 9? And he said, sure. And he got his motorcycle corps all organized. Well, about 6:30 in the morning on the 6th of June, we're all at Lafayette Bridge, 300 troops. you know, all in their berets and their fatigues, and it's kind of rainy, you know, really kind of crummy weather. And this big green Mercedes pulls up, and door opens, the guy opens up the back door, and there's General Gavin. Well, I'm looking at him, and he's kind of hunched over, you know, like this, and he's got a little cane, and he's got his beret on, red beret, and he's kind of hunched over, and he's all shaky like that. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, I made a horrible mistake. You know, I'm subjecting this guy to the weather and his illness, and he's not going to be able to pull it off. He's going to be embarrassed, and the troops are going to be embarrassed. You know, I'm thinking my career has come to an end, and I just did something incredibly stupid. Well, he kind of looks up at me like that, and he looks up beyond me, and he sees all the troops all right arrayed there. He gets out, stands up, walks to the troops, and he is the commander at that location for an hour and a half. Mm-hmm. And he walked us through with crystal clarity what happened. And he was the commanding general. Yeah, yeah. There's no doubt in your mind. Not a hint of illness, not a hint of mental issues whatsoever. And he briefed us on everything. And then he walked us actually down the road, stopping at each location to point out something to us. It was one of the most incredible personal experiences, man, I'd ever had. And just how the strength of character and his resolution came through to overcome all the problems and issues that he had at the time.
That's a tour guide through time. That's amazing.
Really cool.
It's a blessing to get those. You don't ever, that never happens.
Marcus and I I've got tears in my eyes because I'm thinking of Marcus and I and a bunch of other people. We got to bring a World War II veteran, R.V. Bergen. He fought in the Pacific, to Peleliu, the island of Peleliu, Orange Beach. And that was his first time back. And this was in 2014.
Marine, he's 90 Marine. Plus years old. Yeah. I mean, you can still shave with the crease in his pants.
Yeah.
He made
yeah.
sure he on point, like his gig line, belt buckle. I mean, the guy was on point.
Yeah. And we got to bring him back and just see the emotion and everything that he had. And we literally like got out on Orange Beach out of this little boat. And, and he gave us kind of that same story of everything that happened and walked us through the jungle, through Peleliu.
You go to the Umarbrogel?
I don't know that name.
Umarbrogel Ridge, that was the key terrain feature at Peleliu.
Ridge. Yeah. They called it the Bloody Nose Ridge.
So I was in the middle. Yeah. And then the two left flanks. No, I didn't get up there. Were 200 went in, 7 made, or 0, or whatever it was. That crazy.
It was a crazy number of people that died. No, we did go up there because we saw that anti-aircraft gun that was up on that ridge.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they had that. They still have it today, this huge anti-aircraft gun.
Hey, if anybody out there is looking for a vacation, if you like have an adventure. It's a long... An adventure, not a vacation.
It's
vacation when you get there.
It's austere.
Right. Yes, sir. Very, very austere.
It was one of the neatest moments.
I mean, beautiful.
But R.V. Bergen passed away a few years ago, but it makes me think of your experience. Obviously, that's...
Yeah, well, that's why I have this obsession about Normandy. You know, I was kind of fixated on it as a kid for whatever reason. So it always kind of stuck with me. I read a lot about it. And then, of course, when I got into the division, we had a lot of veterans there. 1965... The senior officer leadership were all World War II vets.
Sure.
All the senior NCOs were. So you're getting all these stories from the people who were actually there. And then vets would come filtering back. And, like Gavin came back, Ridgway came back, lots of old NCOs. And they come into the company, walk around. They just sit there and bullshit with you about, you know, what you're doing and what did and how they did it. It's just great professional learning experience. And then to actually have the vets lead us through these staff rides at Normandy, you know, Omaha Beach, Pointe du Hoc, Lafayette Bridge, Chef DuPont, Nouvelle Aplomb, St. Mary, you know, all these things. And they just sit there and walk. Okay, this is what we did. And I was over here and Joe was over there and the gun was here and the Germans were here. You could see it all, you know, and you get the human insights to it beyond.
Oh, yeah.
You got what I call the, you know, the faces and the voices that were really there that made the facts, you know, so much more rewarding. And then after my retirement, I would go back every year to actually do the terrain walks for the active duty troops. And we would always have vets there at that time. You know, this is first time I was there was 1977. You know, so we had a lot of vets. But no celebrations. There was no big deal. It was just, they were just there with their families wandering around, show them where they were at. And then later on, like beginning in the, for the 50th anniversary, it started to become something important. We have vets there and they, you know, I'd be taking, you know, like say 50 troops from the 82nd. We're standing on the ground and a couple of vets would be there and I ask them to talk about it. And they would just, you know, matter of fact, military conversation. They didn't restrain themselves.
Yeah.
And it was kind of unique because we'd have the active duty guys there. Then we had the vets and the vets would talk about what occurred on the ground. You could see ground's not changed pretty much the way it was. Normandy is kind of the Arkansas of France. So it hadn't been a lot of development going on there. And so you can see.
That's a great way to say that. Can I steal that from you?
The Arkansas.
It's yours.
Thank you.
The vets would talk, you know, about what they were doing. Very, you know, they weren't restrained because, you know, they were in a civilian society. They were back in the Army. And so they would talk just like they were back in the Army. And it was really, you know, educational. And you could see stuff you couldn't pick up from the books. And then later on, we'd be walking back and one of the family members would grab me and he'd say, I'd never known that. He's never said that before. We know more today than we had in the entire 30 years we've known him before.
How about that?
You know, and this was quite a common occurrence. So when I go back every year now, of course, there are no vets there. You know, I try to be a bridge between what the originals told me about what occurred on this ground and the actives today. And you can see the actives, man, it lights up their fire. The first day they're kind of, you know, what am I doing here? Where's the beer? You know, yeah. How long do I have to stay here?
Yeah.
You know, man, the normal troop attitude. And then by the
That's
end
real.
Of the second day, they're, you know, I had an old platoon sergeant. We had like, I'm going to say at least 8 deployments to the sandboxes.
Ugh.
And he was always kind of aloof. But at the end of the second day, he came up to me and he pulled me on the arm. And I looked around to him and I said, yeah. And he said, sir, some shit happened here.
Hmm.
And, you know, that was the kind of impact that it made on the active. So, you know, I consider it kind of my worthwhile gift, if you would, on a continuing basis to the Army as a whole.
Do you still go back?
I go back every year, yes.
Oh, I want to go.
So we were, that's fine. I missed the, there's been a couple of chances.
Yeah.
We were just in D.C. yesterday or the day before now. And
like we were there for a week is what I was saying.
Oh, yeah. Visiting the memorials. Walking through, we caught them at night. But just to see all the veterans walking around there. Not very many of them guys left or gals. Mm-hmm. I have a wasp in my neighborhood or down the road from here. She's awesome. She's 103.
Yeah.
I mean, they're still around, but they're hard to find.
She was a wasp.
Right.
And,
yeah.
That's amazing. Okay. We're still taking
Yeah, I'll sit here and talk to you. Yeah. About, I mean, we're not even halfway through.
Yeah.
All right. So, and none of your kids serve or are any of them joined?
Yeah. My oldest son was an 11B in the 3rd Infantry Division. I got 2 boys. The oldest one went, like I said, was in the 3rd ID as an 11B, and 2 girls, 2 boys and 2 girls. The second boy did not serve. He went to the University of Georgia and was primarily engaged in beer and girls.
There's nothing wrong with that. I feel like that's a part of life, especially at Georgia.
Yeah.
great institution of higher learning, football. I go all day about it too.
Yeah.
Just learning.
So after you did that with the 82nd Airborne, you're still in the military when you did that first trek. What, fill us in on the rest of your...
Yeah, I mean, you did a South America stretch. There's some stuff in here about Escobar. That was you on that?
Yeah, that came later. When I left the battalion in the 82nd, I went to the 1st Ranger Battalion, 175. I gave up command of 2505 and then took over command of 175, the Rangers. From there, I went to the Army War College. And from there, I went to the Ranger Training Brigade. And from there, General Thurman and General Downing took me down to Southern Command. To set up an entirely new organization. Acronym was DDN, which doesn't mean anything, but basically it was responsible for all the counter drug operations of the United States in Latin America. I had a, call it an intra-departmental organization. I had FBI, I had DEA, I had CIA, NSA, all of the services to include the Coast Guard. And we were responsible for monitoring all of the drug industry, if you would, in Latin America, and primarily had two basic missions other than the big picture. One was to train and support the host nation forces and their own inter-country strikes against drug forces. The cocoa plantations, the processing plants, the druggie headquarters. We would train up, say, the Colombian forces, and then we would provide them the intel. We put them on board the AWACS, which is actually provided by customs, and they would run a strike with all the support that we could give them, short of actually troops on the ground. So we did that in Bolivia, Colombia, Peru, and Ecuador, and to a little degree in Venezuela. The other thing we did, which became, again, luck and timing, was get Pablo Escobar. And so we created a task force specifically focused to bring U.S. assets to support the Colombian government in getting Escobar. We created an organization, a police organization called the Search Block.
Yeah, sure did. That's exactly what they were called.
We had a compound built for them so the families could be there away from any attempt by the bad guys to pressure the families into flipping their dad, which is what they'd been doing before. So we had a whole village built up, you know, it had a church, schools, movie, bar, the whole thing. So the families could all be self-contained, the Search Block families. So the baddies couldn't get to them. We did a very thorough vetting job of all these Search Block membership. Colonel Fernandez, super guy in charge. Then we just started providing the Overwatch intel. With all of the U.S. intel assets, if you would, we would feed that information to Fernandez. And we just had started with what I call the onion skin approach. They were picking up a lot of cell phone traffic of his surveillance guys and watchdogs and lesser lights in Medellin. And so the Search Block guys would just go out there and whack them or capture them. And then suddenly Escobar's little organization got smaller and smaller and smaller. They started shooting each other because they figured everybody else was a snitch. So it had this kind of ongoing revolt to the point where Escobar was just, it had a very small organization and he was pretty desperate. And that just by chance was kind of the day that he decided to get on his cell phone and talk to his son, which was a major mistake because the Search Block guys were already down there in the neighborhood. And then the rest is history. I was sitting in Panama watching the whole thing. We had a our customs bird up on top with a FLIR, watching the whole thing go down.
I know that story.
That's
yes, sir.
So cool.
That's amazing. Just going in and setting that up and peeling that back, like you said, like an onion. There's so many layers of that story that you just told us. If your kids don't know how cool you are, that's probably one of the coolest stories out there. I mean, they still talk about the 80s and Miami and Columbia and all the men. What's that, Narco?
Yeah.
I mean, just the shows that are coming out. That's the thing, man. You spent your whole life making all these stories, and they hadn't even, I mean, they're barely coming out now.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Thank you for your service, by the way.
Pretty good. There are a lot of factual issues, but I mean, in terms of the atmosphere and the conditions they worked under and the environment, it's pretty accurate. Facts are bad, the personalities are wrong, but the actual story is pretty good.
So you're sitting up, Tom, and what was that like? Did you ever have a moment where you just kind of pinched yourself like, okay, I'm in Colombia and we're running this. I've also been to Vietnam.
Yeah, right. And all of these moments, which one's the one that's been like, hey, that was...
Did you ever have that moment of just that, my life is very interesting while it was in it?
No, I don't think you think about it at the time. It's kind of like getting shot at, you know? You don't think about what might happen. You just do what you have to do. Yeah. And it's only later you kind of get into reflection when you've got the moment something is happening, you got your adrenaline going, you got your focus going, you're trying to figure out what needs to be done. It's kind of like being a football coach. Yeah. The team's out there, you're on the goal line, you're about to get in, you're looking all around. Well, you know, how do we manage the defense? Where do we position our guys? You know, what's the best play for the situation? So it's, you know, like when Pablo was going down, we're watching all this. We got all of these things going there. You know, there's a whole bunch of moving parts at the same time.
Right.
And you're trying to monitor each of those moving parts. And you're trying to make sure they all get together at the right point and the right focus to get what you need to do. And suddenly, bam, there it's happened. You know, that's it. It's only later you kind of think, wow. Like the sergeant told me, this is some shit.
Yeah.
is there one of those moments where you kind of, if you could reflect back and say, hey, where you were in the moment, you're like, shit, man, I didn't think I was going to pull that one out.
Well, I probably Suey Long. You know, I'm working on my 12th M16 magazine, you know, with these little people coming at me. And, you know, it's just constant adrenaline. You're doing your thing. You're, you know, fire, release, empty the magazine, jam in a new magazine, fire, keep on going. And you said, you know, you think, you know, how much longer can I do this? You know, this, you know, it's just, you understand that life is karmic and that something is going to happen. It's going to happen. There's nothing you can do to control it. So don't worry about it because you can't manage it. Just focus on what you need to do and nature will take care of itself. I don't know if that answers your question or not.
Hell, well, it does. It actually answers the next one, too. I was like, hey, if you could leave us with some advice, like all this that you've gone through and keep stacking it up. And I know in the reflection phase, even right now, it's tough. But for everyone listening out here, all that you've been through and that you put together and that you learned, can you drop us a little piece of wisdom?
Words of wisdom? Do your best when you have a chance to do something. I mean, that's all I can really say. I mean, most people aren't able to plan for what the issues of their future really bring. You just have to be prepared to do what the best that you can when nature gives you an opportunity. Be good to people. You know, people is what makes things work. It's ultimately the only thing that really counts. It's like family. You got to pay attention to people around you. Rank is not important. Production is. The quality of the person is what comes through. And if there's any one thing I could say is that simply do the best you can when you have a chance to do it, because you may not get another chance. And this may be really important, not only for you, but, you know, for the people around you, you know, or for the country as a whole. These things come to you in time. They don't come to you at the moment it occurs. So you just have to basically be yourself and be honest with yourself and do the best you can regardless of the circumstances.
So but there's so much that I know Marcus wants to ask, and I do. We're unfortunately on a time constraint, so we're trying to cut to some things. What, when you wrote your book, what year was that? And what, how did you figure out what to put in there? Did you include everything?
Which book are you speaking of?
The Phoenix Rising.
Phoenix Rising. I mentioned to you that I was the gopher. Yeah. In the organization. I kept kind of a journal, but it was more of kind of call it essays, if you would, because it was cathartic to me. I'd come home and I would, something would have happened during the day or an issue, a personality, and I just didn't write about it. And that kind of, that was kind of my evening cocktail, if you would, to de-stress. And so I collected these, obviously, over the time of the operation. And then later we had this hugely stressful event of the construction of these special ops forces after the rescue. And all the fighting that we had to do with the institutions and the bureaucracy to get this stuff done. Great frustration. But I kept a lot of the notes and all that I wasn't supposed to keep. I kept...
I did that too.
Yeah.
And then so, you know, as time goes on, special ops became what I call a self-licking ice cream cone. You know, it was wonderful and shiny and everybody thought it was the greatest thing in the world and, you know, all that good stuff. Well, I remember what it was like before. And so I said, hey, we need to get a little truth and lending here. And so I just put together my journal comments as part one, which was how we got through the rescue and all of the background to that. And then part two was the fight to actually create the forces everybody now loved. You know, it was the bin Laden thing, Desert One to right. Osama bin Laden. How did we get there? Well, the book is simply an attempt to depict as factually as possible what actually occurred that created the capability to get bin Laden. So, you know, that's basically how I kludged the book together. The Vietnam book was much easier. I wrote that over the course of 3 weekends, very little editing. What you read in that book is basically what just came off of my, at that time, K-Pro computer.
Wow. Are those the only two books that you have?
No. I have another book self-published on Amazon called Reflections, which is a whole series of essays of the various that I wrote about various campaigns I had been associated with and Normandy, which was kind of my obsession. That's on Amazon. And there's another book coming out in February called Normandy, the Faces Behind the Facts.
That was going to be my next question.
The Human Face of D-Day, which is a discussion of Normandy with the vets' comments to me that I picked up over all of my long periods with them, from the generals down to the privates. You know, why was Normandy selected? Why was this beach selected? Yeah. What actually occurred at this location with the vet's comments to me at each of those sites. That's coming out, like I said, in February.
Oh, that's the best because that puts the spice. That's like putting the spice inside the commentary is the best, especially when you have the from a private to a general, because what comes out of their mouth in a similar situation, and actually in the exact situation, is two different things. And that's where you find it. That's awesome.
One of the things you find, I found with the vets, which was true in my own experience, is that you could put four people on the same battle site fighting the same fight They're less than 20 meters apart, and they got four different views of what actually occurred.
How about that?
Every one of them is absolutely true.
Absolutely right.
Yeah, and you put them together,
it's like Lafayette Bridge. I mean, I got Gavin telling us this happened, and I got Private Schmuckatelli telling us this is what happened.
Yeah.
And neither one of them have any idea what the other was doing. But you put it all together, you get the picture.
That's how you get your angles.
Yeah.
You could tell how obtuse their angle was by that.
I'm so glad that you're doing that. That was going to be my next question when you were talking is, are you going to do something about Normandy? Because hearing those stories, I mean, you were put in a priceless position to be able to soak up all of those stories. And for you to actually put it on paper is really incredible.
Well, yeah, it's like I said, it's an obsession. And I'm an old guy, got time on my hands, so I want to do it. You know, old folks always look for legacy. Well, you know, my legacy, if I have one, is the bridge between what the vets said and what the active duty see and they appreciate, you know, and they get it. My idea has always been that, you know, we take the 82nd guys today and they're walking at Lafayette Bridge and they got a couple of vets talking to them. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, when that active duty troop is in some dark place somewhere and, you know, the world's coming to an end, he's going to think about what that vet did at Lafayette Bridge. And he's going to say, hey, if he can do it, I can do it.
Yeah.
And it's going to give him a little additional, you know, oomph in his core. And he's going to do what needs to be done.
Yeah, for sure. We interviewed a young kid, like 24, 25, a couple of weeks ago. And his mission is to basically document all of the existing World War II veteran stories, combat World War II veteran stories. And he's going around the country with his camera crew and just doing a video documentary. And all he's doing with it right now is just giving that video to the family of that veteran. Because a lot of times they won't just strike up the conversation and talk about it. So, he went to Normandy, didn't he? He said he went to Normandy. I love when, you know, legacy continues through other people. So we really appreciate you for doing that and for your own service. Golly, I mean, that's
unbelievable.
Yeah.
So what can we do to support you? Do you have a place we can, do you have a website or a place we can promote you?
I don't have a website. No, I am on Facebook, and LinkedIn. And other than that, I'm, you know, just my books on Amazon, you know, buy a couple cases and write glowing 5-star reviews, you know?
Absolutely.
We might have to buy a couple of cases and send them to you to autograph them so we can send them out.
Happy to do so.
This is called the Nightingale present. I was like, if I find anybody who's slacking half-ass, I'm like, whoosh.
Yeah, we would love to support you, and we'll definitely spread the word about your books. And
thank you again for doing this.
Now you did mention that. I'm going to give, can I plug here?
Yeah, absolutely. Plug. Yep.
Normandy Institute is a U.S. 501(c), and it's based actually in Normandy, Chateau Berneville, and its job is to provide an educational outlet for anybody interested in Normandy. It's got a big library. The CEO, Dorothea Della Hussein, has been sponsoring and managing a number of films. The latest one is actually a documentary taken of me doing the staff rides last year. We're turning that into probably a 1-hour documentary, and we're searching for funds now to do that. And what we hope to do is go on, put it together, Henry Roosevelt, who did an award-winning documentary called The Sixth of June, is doing it. And he's going to amalgamate my staff rides with interviews he's done of the vets over time, and come up with like a 1-hour documentary for the History Channel and for maybe the military channel, but we're searching for bucks now. So if anybody wants to donate, go to the Normandy Institute and you'll see the film donation button there, and just, you know, mortgage the ranch and, you know, shovel in money as fast as you can get it.
Yeah, well, we'll definitely share.
So that's
that
my plug.
I love it.
Yes, sir.
Well, Marcus and I might show up in Normandy next year.
Hey, well, this join us. Ironically, a number of my family is going to be there for the first time. And we'll be there from about the 1st through the 7th of June.
Okay.
St. Mary Gleese is the core. So if you show up, I will be happy to have you join our crowd.
Oh, we would love that.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story and the story of all the guys at Normandy.
Happy New Year, and thank you for your service.
My pleasure, anytime.
Keep living your life.
Yes. All right.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Airborne.